April 2000. The Third Expedition. The ship came down from space. It came from the stars and the black velocities and the shining movements and the silent gulfs of space. It was a new ship. It had fire in its body and men in its metal cells, and it moved with a clean silence, fiery and warm. In it were 17 men, including a captain. The crowd at the Ohio field had shouted and waved their hands up into the sunlight, and the rocket had bloomed out great flowers of heat and color and run away into space on the third voyage to Mars. Now it was decelerating with metal efficiency in the upper Martian atmospheres. It was still a thing of beauty and strength. It had moved in the midnight waters of space like a pale sea leviathan. It had passed the ancient moon and thrown itself onward into one nothingness following another. The men within it had been battered, thrown about, sickened, made well again, each in his turn. One man had died, but now the remaining 16, with their eyes clear in their heads and their faces pressed to the thick glass ports, watched Mars swing up under them.
"Mars!" cried Navigator Lustig.
"Good old Mars!"
said Samuel Hingston, archaeologist.
"Well," said Captain John Black.
The rocket landed on a lawn of green grass. Outside, upon this lawn, stood an iron deer. Farther up on the green stood a tall brown Victorian house, quiet in the sunlight, all covered with scrolls and rococo, its windows made of blue and pink and yellow and green colored glass. Upon the porch were hairy geraniums and an old swing which was hooked into the porch ceiling and which now swung back and forth in a little breeze. At the summit of the house was a cupola with diamond leaded glass windows and a dunce cap roof. Through the front window you could see a piece of music titled Beautiful Ohio, sitting on the music rest. Around the rocket in four directions spread the little town, green and motionless in the Martian spring. There were white houses and red brick ones, and tall elm trees blowing in the wind, and tall maples and horse chestnuts, and church steeples with golden bells silent in them. The rocket men looked out and saw this. Then they looked at one another, and then they looked out again. They held to each other's elbows, suddenly unable to breathe, it seemed. Their faces grew pale.
"I'll be damned," whispered Lustig, rubbing his face with his numb fingers. "I'll be damned."
"It just can't be," said Samuel Hingston.
"Lord," said Captain John Black. There was a call from the chemist.
"Sir, the atmosphere is thin for breathing, but there's enough oxygen. It's safe."
"Then we'll go out," said Lustig.
"Hold on," said Captain John Black. "How do we know what this is?"
"It's a small town with thin but breathable air in it, sir."
"And it's a small town the like of Earth towns," said Hingston, the archaeologist. "Incredible. It can't be, but it is."
Captain John Black looked at him idly.
"Do you think that the civilizations of two planets can progress at the same rate and evolve in the same way, Hingston?"
"I wouldn't have thought so, sir."
Captain Black stood by the port.
"Look out there. The geraniums. A specialized plant. That specific variety has only been known on Earth for 50 years. Think of the thousands of years it takes to evolve plants. Then tell me if it's logical that the Martians should have one, leaded glass windows, two, cupolas, three, porch swings, four, an instrument that looks like a piano and probably is a piano, and five, if you look closely through this telescope lens here, is it logical that a Martian composer would have published a piece of music titled, strangely enough, Beautiful Ohio? All of which means that we have an Ohio River on Mars?"
"Captain Williams, of course," cried Hingston.
"What?"
"Captain Williams and his crew of three men. Or Nathaniel York and his partner. That would explain it."
That would explain absolutely nothing. As far as we've been able to figure, the York expedition exploded the day it reached Mars, killing York and his partner. As for Williams and his three men, their ship exploded the second day after their arrival. At least the pulsations from their radio ceased at that time. So we figured that if the men were alive after that, they'd have contacted us. And anyway, the York expedition was only a year ago, while Captain Williams and his men landed here sometime during last August. Theorizing that they are still alive, could they, even with the help of a brilliant Martian race, have built such a town as this and aged it in so short a time? Look at that town out there. Why, it's been standing here for the last 70 years. Look at the wood on the porch knoll. Look at the trees. A century old, all of them. No, this isn't York's work or Williams. It's something else. I don't like it. And I'm not leaving the ship until I know what it is. For that matter, said Lustig, nodding, Williams and his men, as well as York, landed on the opposite side of Mars. We were very careful to land on this side. An excellent point. And just in case a hostile local tribe of Martians killed off York and Williams, we have instructions to land in a farther region to forestall a recurrence of such a disaster. So here we are, as far as we know, in a land that Williams and York never saw.
Damn it, said Hingston. I want to get out into this town, sir, with your permission. It may be there are similar thought patterns, civilization graphs on every planet in our sun system. We may be on the threshold of the greatest psychological and metaphysical discovery of our age.
I'm willing to wait a moment, said Captain John Black.
It may be, sir, that we're looking upon a phenomenon that, for the first time, would absolutely prove the existence of God, sir.
There are many people who are of good faith without such proof, Mr. Hingston.
I'm one myself, sir, but certainly a town like this could not occur without divine intervention. The detail. It fills me with such feelings that I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
Do neither, then, until we know what we're up against.
Up against? Lustig broke in. Against nothing, Captain. It's a good, quiet, green town. A lot like the old-fashioned one I was born in. I like the looks of it.
When were you born, Lustig?
1950, sir.
And you, Hingston?
1955, sir. Grinnell, Iowa. And this looks like home to me.
Hingston, Lustig, I could be either of your fathers. I'm just 80 years old, born in 1920 in Illinois. And through the grace of God and a science that in the last 50 years knows how to make some old men young again, here I am on Mars, not any more tired than the rest of you, but infinitely more suspicious. Now, this town out here looks very peaceful and cool, and so much like Green Bluff, Illinois, that it frightens me. It's too much like Green Bluff. He turned to the radio man.
Radio Earth, tell them we've landed. That's all. Tell them we'll radio a full report tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
Captain Black looked out the rocket port, with his face that should have been the face of a man of 80, but seemed like the face of a man in his 40th year.
Tell you what we'll do, Lustig. You and I and Hingston will look the town over, and the other men will stay aboard. If anything happens, they can get the hell out. A loss of three men's better than a whole ship. If something bad happens, our crew can warn the next rocket. That's Captain Wilder's rocket, I think, due to be ready to take off next Christmas. If there's something hostile about Mars, we certainly want the next rocket to be well armed.
So are we. We've got a regular arsenal with us.
Tell the men to stand by the guns, then. Come on, Lustig, Hingston.
The three men walked together down through the levels of the ship. It was a beautiful spring day. A robin sat on a blossoming apple tree and sang continuously. Showers of petal snow sifted down when the wind touched the green branches, and the blossom scent drifted upon the air. Somewhere in the town, someone was playing the piano. And the music came and went, softly, drowsily. The song was Beautiful Dreamer. Somewhere else a phonograph, scratchy and faded, was hissing out a record of Roamin' Through the Gloamin', sung by Harry Lauder. The three men stood outside the ship.
They sucked and gasped at the thin, thin air and moved slowly so as not to tire themselves. Now the phonograph record being played was, "Oh, give me a June night, the moonlight and you." Lustig began to tremble. Samuel Hingston did likewise. The sky was serene and quiet, and somewhere a stream of water ran through the cool caverns and tree shadings of a ravine. Somewhere a horse and wagon trotted and rolled by, bumping.
"Sir," said Samuel Hingston, "it must be, it has to be, that rocket travel to Mars began in the years before the First World War."
"No.
How else can you explain these houses, the iron deer, the pianos, the music?"
Hingston took the captain's elbow persuasively and looked into the captain's face.
"Say that there were people in the year 1905 who hated war and got together with some scientists in secret and built a rocket and came out here to Mars."
"No, no, Hingston."
"Why not? The world was a different world in 1905. They could have kept it a secret much more easily. But a complex thing like a rocket?
No, you couldn't keep it secret.
And they came up here to live. And naturally, the houses they built were similar to Earth houses, because they brought the culture with them."
"And they've lived here all these years?" said the captain.
"In peace and quiet, yes. Maybe they made a few trips, enough to bring enough people here for one small town, and then stopped for fear of being discovered. That's why this town seems so old-fashioned. I don't see a thing myself older than the year 1927, do you? Or maybe, sir, rocket travel is older than we think. Perhaps it started in some part of the world centuries ago and was kept secret by the small number of men who came to Mars with only occasional visits to Earth over the centuries."
"You make it sound almost reasonable."
"It has to be. We've the proof here before us. All we have to do is find some people and verify it."
Their boots were deadened of all sound in the thick green grass. It smelled from a fresh mowing. In spite of himself, Captain John Black felt a great peace come over him. It had been 30 years since he had been in a small town, and the buzzing of spring bees on the air lulled and quieted him, and the fresh look of things was a balm to the soul. They set foot upon the porch. Hollow echoes sounded from under the boards as they walked to the screen door. Inside they could see a bead curtain hung across the hall entry, and a crystal chandelier, and a Maxfield Parrish painting framed on one wall over a comfortable Morris chair. The house smelled old and of the attic and infinitely comfortable. You could hear the tinkle of ice in a lemonade pitcher. In a distant kitchen, because of the heat of the day, someone was preparing a cold lunch. Someone was humming under her breath, high and sweet. Captain John Black rang the bell. Footsteps, dainty and thin, came along the hall, and a kind-faced lady of some 40 years, dressed in the sort of dress you might expect in the year 1909, peered out of them.
"Can I help you?"
she asked. "Beg your pardon," said Captain Black uncertainly, "but we're looking for... that is, could you help us?" He stopped. She looked out at him with dark, wondering eyes.
"If you're selling something," she began.
"No, wait," he cried. "What town is this?" She looked him up and down.
"What do you mean, what town is this? How could you be in a town and not know the name?"
The captain looked as if he wanted to go sit under a shady apple tree. "We're strangers here. We want to know how this town got here and how you got here."
"Are you census takers?"
"No."
"Everyone knows," she said, "this town was built in 1868. Is this a game?"
"No, not a game," cried the captain. "We're from Earth."
"Out of the ground, do you mean?"
she wondered. "No. We came from the third planet, Earth, in a ship, and we've landed here on the fourth planet, Mars."
"This,"
explained the woman, as if she were addressing a child, "is Green Bluff, Illinois, on the continent of America, surrounded by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, on a place called the World, or sometimes the Earth. Go away now.
Goodbye. She trotted down the hall, running her fingers through the beaded curtains. The three men looked at one another.
Let's knock the screen door in, said Lustig.
We can't do that. This is private property. Good God. They went to sit down on the porch step.
Did it ever strike you, Hingston, that perhaps we got ourselves somehow, in some way, off track, and by accident came back and landed on Earth?
How could we have done that?
I don't know. I don't know. Oh, God, let me think.
Hingston said, but we checked every mile of the way. Our chronometers said so many miles. We went past the moon and out into space, and here we are. I'm positive we're on Mars.
Lustig said, but suppose by accident in space, in time, we got lost in the dimensions and landed on an Earth that is 30 or 40 years ago.
Oh, go away, Lustig.
Lustig went to the door, rang the bell, and called into the cool, dim rooms.
What year is this?
1926, of course,
said the lady, sitting in a rocking chair, taking a sip of her lemonade.
Did you hear that?
Lustig turned wildly to the others.
1926! We have gone back in time. This is the Earth.
Lustig sat down, and the three men let the wonder and terror of the thought afflict them. Their hands stirred fitfully on their knees. The captain said,
I didn't ask for a thing like this. It scares the hell out of me. How can a thing like this happen? I wish we'd brought Einstein with us.
Will anyone in this town believe us? Said Hingston. Are we playing with something dangerous? Time, I mean. Shouldn't we just take off and go home?
No, not until we try another house.
They walked three houses down to a little white cottage under an oak tree.
I like to be as logical as I can be, said the captain. And I don't believe we put our finger on it yet. Suppose, Hingston, as you originally suggested, that rocket travel occurred years ago. And when the Earth people lived here a number of years, they began to get homesick for Earth. First, a mild neurosis about it. Then a full-fledged psychosis. Then threatened insanity. What would you do as a psychiatrist if faced with such a problem?
Hingston thought.
Well, I think I'd arrange the civilization on Mars so it resembled Earth more and more each day. If there was any way of reproducing every plant, every road, and every lake, and even an ocean, I'd do so. Then, by some vast crowd hypnosis, I'd convince everyone in a town this size that this really was Earth, not Mars at all.
Good enough, Hingston. I think we're on the right track now.
That woman in that house there just thinks she's living on Earth. It protects her sanity. She and all the others in this town are the patients of the greatest experiment in migration and hypnosis you will ever lay eyes on in your life.
That's it, sir, cried Lustig.
Right, said Hingston.
Well, the captain sighed. Now we've got somewhere, I feel better. It's all a bit more logical. That talk about time and going back and forth and traveling through time turns my stomach upside down. But this way, the captain smiled. Well, well, it looks as if we'll be fairly popular here.
Or will we? Said Lustig. After all, like the pilgrims, these people came here to escape Earth. Maybe they won't be too happy to see us. Maybe they'll try to drive us out or kill us.
We have superior weapons. This next house now. Up we go.
But they had hardly crossed the lawn when Lustig stopped and looked off across the town, down the quiet, dreaming afternoon street.
Sir, he said.
What is it, Lustig?
Oh, sir. Sir, what I see, said Lustig.
And he began to cry. His fingers came up, twisting and shaking, and his face was all wonder and joy and incredulity. He sounded as if, at any moment, he might go quite insane with happiness. He looked down the street and began to run, stumbling awkwardly, falling, picking himself up, and running on.
Look! Look!
Don't let him get away!
The captain broke into a run. Now Lustig was running swiftly, shouting.
He turned into a yard halfway down the shady street and leaped up upon the porch of a large green house with an iron rooster on the roof. He was beating at the door, hollering and crying, when Hingston and the captain ran up behind him. They were all gasping and wheezing, exhausted from their run in the thin air. "Grandma! Grandpa!" cried Lustig. Two old people stood in the doorway.
"David!"
their voices piped, and they rushed out to embrace and pat him on the back and move around him.
"David! Oh, David, it's been so many years. How you've grown, boy. How big you are, boy. Oh, David, boy, how are you?"
"Grandma! Grandpa!" sobbed David Lustig.
"You look fine. Fine."
He held them, turned them, kissed them, hugged them, cried on them, held them out again, blinking at the little old people. The sun was in the sky, the wind blew, the grass was green, the screen door stood wide.
"Come in, boy, come in. There's iced tea for you, fresh, lots of it."
"I've got friends here."
Lustig turned and waved at the captain and Hingston, frantically, laughing.
"Captain, come on up."
"Howdy," said the old people. "Come in. Any friends of David's are our friends, too. Don't stand there."
In the living room of the old house, it was cool, and the grandfather clock ticked high and long and bronzed in one corner. There were soft pillows on large couches, and walls filled with books, and a rug cut in a thick rose pattern, and iced tea in the hand, sweating, and cool on the thirsty tongue.
"Here's to our health."
Grandma tipped her glass to her porcelain teeth.
"How long have you been here, Grandma?" said Lustig. "Ever since we died," she said tartly.
"Ever since you what?" Captain John Black set down his glass.
"Oh, yes,"
Lustig nodded.
"They've been dead 30 years.
"And you sit there calmly?"
shouted the captain.
"Tush,"
the old woman winked glitteringly.
"Who are you to question what happens? Here we are. What's life, anyway? Who does what, for why, and where? All we know is here we are, alive again, and no questions asked. A second chance."
She toddled over and held out her thin wrist.
"Feel."
The captain felt.
"Solid, ain't it?"
she asked. He nodded.
"Well, then," she said triumphantly, "why go around questioning?"
"Well," said the captain, "it's simply that we never thought we'd find a thing like this on Mars."
"And now you've found it. I dare say there's lots on every planet that'll show you God's infinite ways."
"Is this heaven?"
asked Hingston.
"Nonsense, no. It's a world, and we get a second chance. Nobody told us why. But then nobody told us why we were on Earth, either. That other Earth, I mean. The one you came from. How do we know there wasn't another before that one?"
"A good question," said the captain. Lustig kept smiling at his grandparents.
"Gosh, it's good to see you. Gosh, it's good."
The captain stood up and slapped his hand on his leg in a casual fashion.
"We've got to be going. Thank you for the drinks."
"You'll be back, of course," said the old people. "For supper tonight?"
"We'll try to make it, thanks. There's so much to be done. My men are waiting for me back at the rocket, and..."
He stopped. He looked towards the door, startled. Far away in the sunlight, there was a sound of voices, a shouting and a great hello.
"What's that?"
asked Hingston.
"We'll soon find out."
And Captain John Black was out of the front door abruptly, running across the green lawn into the street of the Martian town. He stood looking at the rocket. The ports were open, and his crew was streaming out, waving their hands. A crowd of people had gathered, and in and through and among these people, the members of the crew were hurrying, talking, laughing, shaking hands. People did little dances. People swarmed. The rocket lay empty and abandoned. A brass band exploded in the sunlight, flinging off a gay tune from upraised tubas and trumpets. There was a bang of drums and a shrill of fifes. Little girls with golden hair jumped up and down. Little boys shouted, "Hooray!" Fat men passed around 10-cent cigars. The town mayor made a speech. Then each member of the crew, with a mother on one arm, a father or sister on the other, was spirited off down the street into little cottages or big mansions.
"Stop!" cried Captain Black.
The doors slammed shut. The heat rose in the clear spring sky, and all was silent. The brass band banged off around a corner, leaving the rocket to shine and dazzle alone in the sunlight.
"Abandoned," said the captain. "They abandoned the ship, they did. I'll have their skins, by God. They had orders."
"Sir," said Lustig, "don't be too hard on them. Those were all old relatives and friends."
"That's no excuse."
"Think how they felt, Captain, seeing familiar faces outside the ship."
"They had their orders, damn it."
"But how would you have felt, Captain?"
"I would have obeyed orders."
The captain's mouth remained open. Striding along the sidewalk, under the Martian sun, tall, smiling, eyes amazingly clear and blue, came a young man of some 26 years.
"John!"
the man called out, and broke into a trot.
"What?"
Captain John Black swayed.
"John, you old son of a bitch!"
The man ran up and gripped his hand and slapped him on the back.
"It's you,"
said Captain Black.
"Of course. Who do you think it was?"
"Edward."
The captain appealed now to Lustig and Hingston, holding the stranger's hand.
"This is my brother, Edward. Ed, meet my men. Lustig, Hingston, my brother."
They tugged at each other's hands and arms and then finally embraced.
"Ed! John, you bum, you! You're looking fine, Ed, but... Ed, what is this? You haven't changed over the years. You died, I remember, when you were 26 and I was 19. Good God, so many years ago, and here you are, and... Lord, what goes on?"
"Mom's waiting," said Edward Black, grinning.
"Mom?
And Dad, too."
"Dad?"
The captain almost fell as if he'd been hit by a mighty weapon. He walked stiffly and without coordination.
"Mom and Dad alive? Where?"
"At the old house on Oak Knoll Avenue."
"The old house?"
The captain stared in delighted amaze.
"Did you hear that, Lustig? Hingston?"
Hingston was gone. He had seen his own house down the street and was running for it. Lustig was laughing.
"You see, Captain, what happened to everyone on the rocket? They couldn't help themselves."
"Yes. Yes."
The captain shut his eyes.
"When I open my eyes, you'll be gone."
He blinked.
"You're still there. God, Ed, but you look fine. Come on. Lunch is waiting. I told Mom."
Lustig said, "Sir, I'll be with my grand folks if you need me."
"What?
Oh, fine, Lustig. Later, then." Edward seized his arm and marched him.
"There's the house. Remember it?"
"Hell,
bet I can beat you to the front porch."
They ran. The trees roared over Captain Black's head. The earth roared under his feet. He saw the golden figure of Edward Black pull ahead of him in the amazing dream of reality. He saw the house rush forward, the screen door swing wide.
"Beat you!"
cried Edward.
"I'm an old man," panted the captain, "and you're still young. But then, you always beat me, I remember."
In the doorway, Mom, pink, plump, and bright. Behind her, pepper gray, Dad, his pipe in his hand.
"Mom! Dad!"
He ran up the steps like a child to meet them. It was a fine, long afternoon. They finished a late lunch, and they sat in the parlor, and he told them all about his rocket, and they nodded and smiled upon him, and Mother was just the same, and Dad bit the end off a cigar and lighted it thoughtfully in his old fashion. There was a big turkey dinner at night, and time flowing on. When the drumsticks were sucked clean and lay brittle upon the plates, the captain leaned back and exhaled his deep satisfaction. Night was in all the trees and coloring the sky, and the lamps were halos of pink light in the gentle house. From all the other houses down the street came sounds of music, pianos playing, doors slamming. Mom put a record on the Victrola, and she and Captain John Black had a dance. She was wearing the same perfume he remembered from the summer when she and Dad had been killed in the train accident. She was very real in his arms as they danced lightly to the music. "It's not every day," she said, "you get a second chance to live." "I'll wake in the morning," said the captain, "and I'll be in my rocket, in space, and all this will be gone."
"No, don't think that," she cried softly. "Don't question. God's good to us. Let us be happy."
"Sorry, Mom." The record ended in a circular hissing. "You're tired, son," Dad pointed with his pipe. "Your old bedroom's waiting for you, brass bed and all." "But I should report my men in."
"Why?"
"Why? Well, I don't know. No reason, I guess. No, none at all. They're all eating or in bed. A good night's sleep won't hurt them."
"Good night, son."
Mom kissed his cheek.
"It's good to have you home."
"It's good to be home." He left the land of cigar smoke and perfume and books and gentle light and ascended the stairs, talking with Edward. Edward pushed a door open, and there was the yellow brass bed and the old banners from college and a very musty raccoon coat which he stroked with muted affection.
"It's too much," said the captain. "I'm numb and I'm tired. Too much has happened today. I feel as if I'd been out in a pounding rain for 48 hours without an umbrella or a coat. I'm soaked to the skin with emotion."
Edward slapped wide the snowy linens and flounced the pillows. He slid the window up and let the night-blooming jasmine float in. There was moonlight and the sound of distant dancing and whispering.
"So this is Mars," said the captain, undressing. "This is it."
Edward undressed in idle, leisurely moves, drawing his shirt off over his head, revealing golden shoulders and the good, muscular neck. The lights were out. They were in bed, side by side, as in the days how many decades ago? The captain lolled and was nourished by the scent of jasmine, pushing the lace curtains out upon the dark air of the room. Among the trees, upon a lawn, someone had cranked up a portable phonograph, and now it was playing softly. "Always." The thought of Marilyn came to his mind. "Is Marilyn here?" His brother, lying straight out in the moonlight from the window, waited and then said,
"Yes, she's out of town, but she'll be here in the morning."
The captain shut his eyes.
"I want to see Marilyn very much."
The room was square and quiet, except for their breathing.
"Good night, Ed."
A pause.
"Good night, John."
He lay peacefully, letting his thoughts float. For the first time, the stress of the day was moved aside. He could think logically now. It had all been emotion, the bands playing, the familiar faces. But now, how, he wondered. How was all this made, and why? For what purpose? Out of the goodness of some divine intervention? Was God, then, really that thoughtful of his children? How and why and what for? He considered the various theories advanced in the first heat of the afternoon by Hingston and Lustig. He let all kinds of new theories drop in lazy pebbles down through his mind, turning, throwing out dull flashes of light. Mom, Dad, Edward, Mars, Earth. Mars. Martians. Who had lived here 1,000 years ago on Mars? Martians? Or had this always been the way it was today? Martians. He repeated the word idly, inwardly. He laughed out loud almost. He had the most ridiculous theory quite suddenly. It gave him a kind of chill. It was really nothing to consider, of course.
highly improbable. Silly. Forget it. Ridiculous. But he thought, just suppose. Just suppose now that there were Martians living on Mars, and they saw our ship coming, and saw us inside our ship, and hated us. Suppose now, just for the hell of it, that they wanted to destroy us as invaders, as unwanted ones, and they wanted to do it in a very clever way, so that we would be taken off guard. Well, what would be the best weapon that a Martian could use against Earthmen with atomic weapons? The answer was interesting. Telepathy, hypnosis, memory, and imagination. Suppose all of these houses aren't real at all, this bed not real, but only figments of my own imagination, given substance by telepathy and hypnosis through the Martians, thought Captain John Black. Suppose these houses are really some other shape, a Martian shape, but by playing on my desires and wants, these Martians have made this seem like my old hometown, my old house, to lull me out of my suspicion. What better way to fool a man, using his own mother and father as bait? And this town, so old, from the year 1926, long before any of my men were born, from a year when I was 6 years old, and there were records of Harry Lauder and Maxfield Parrish paintings still hanging, and bead curtains, and beautiful Ohio, and turn-of-the-century architecture. What if the Martians took the memories of a town exclusively from my mind? They say childhood memories are the clearest. And after they built the town from my mind, they populated it with the most loved people from all the minds of the people on the rocket. And suppose those two people in the next room asleep are not my mother and father at all, but two Martians, incredibly brilliant, with the ability to keep me under hypnosis all of the time. And that brass band today, what a startlingly wonderful plan it would be. First, fool Lustig, then Hingston, then gather a crowd, and all the men in the rocket, seeing mothers, aunts, uncles, sweethearts, dead 10, 20 years ago, naturally disregarding orders, rush out and abandon ship. What more natural? What more unsuspecting? What more simple? A man doesn't ask too many questions when his mother is suddenly brought back to life. He's much too happy. And here we all are tonight, in various houses, in various beds, with no weapons to protect us. And the rocket lies in the moonlight, empty. And wouldn't it be horrible and terrifying to discover that all of this was part of some great, clever plan by the Martians to divide and conquer us, and kill us? Sometime during the night, perhaps, my brother, here on this bed, will change form, melt, shift, and become another thing, a terrible thing, a Martian. It would be very simple for him just to turn over in bed and put a knife into my heart. And in all those other houses down the street, a dozen other brothers or fathers suddenly melting away and taking knives and doing things to the unsuspecting, sleeping men of Earth. His hands were shaking under the covers. His body was cold. Suddenly it was not a theory. Suddenly he was very afraid. He lifted himself in bed and listened. The night was very quiet. The music had stopped. The wind had died. His brother lay sleeping beside him. Carefully, he lifted the covers, rolled them back. He slipped from the bed and was walking softly across the room when his brother's voice said, "Where are you going?" "What?" His brother's voice was quite cold. "I said, where do you think you're going?" "For a drink of water."
"But you're not thirsty."
"Yes. Yes, I am."
"No, you're not."
Captain John Black broke and ran across the room. He screamed. He screamed twice.
he never reached the door. In the morning, the brass band played a mournful dirge. From every house in the street came little solemn processions bearing long boxes, and along the sun-filled street, weeping, came the grandmas and mothers and sisters and brothers and uncles and fathers walking to the churchyard, where there were new holes freshly dug and new tombstones installed. 16 holes in all, and 16 tombstones. The mayor made a little speech, his face sometimes looking like the mayor, sometimes looking like something else. Mother and Father Black were there, with Brother Edward, and they cried, their faces melting now from a familiar face into something else. Grandpa and Grandma Lustig were there, weeping, their faces shifting like wax, shimmering as all things shimmer on a hot day. The coffins were lowered. Someone murmured about the unexpected and sudden deaths of 16 fine men during the night. Earth pounded down on the coffin lids. The brass band playing Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, marched and slammed back into town, and everyone took the day off.